There were people hanging around out there, in little groups of three or four, talking among themselves and occasionally turning to look at the watch house. Vimes sat down on the steps and took a sip of his cocoa. He might as well have dropped his britches. The groups opened up and became an audience. No man drinking a non-alcoholic chocolate beverage had ever been the centre of so much attention. He'd been right. A closed door is an incitement to bravery. A man drinking from a mug under a light and apparently enjoying the cool night air is an incitement to pause.
"We're breaking curfew, you know," said a young man with a quick dart forward, dart back movement.
"Is that right?" said Vimes.
"Are you going to arrest us, then?"
"Not me," said Vimes cheerfully. "I'm on me break."
"Yeah?" said the man.
He pointed to Colon and Waddy.
"Are they on their break too?"
"They are now."
Vimes half turned.
"Brews up, lads. Off you go. No, no need to run. There's enough for everyone. And come back out when you've got it."
When the sound of pounding boots had died away, Vimes turned back and smiled at the group again.
"So when do you come off your break?" said the man.
Vimes paid him some extra attention. The stance was a giveaway. He was ready to fight, even though he didn't look like a fighter. If this were a barroom, the bartender would be taking the more expensive bottles off the shelf, because amateurs like that tended to spread the glass around. Ah, yes. And now he could see why the words barroom had occurred to him. There was a bottle sticking out of the man's pocket. He'd been drinking his defiance.
"Oh, around Thursday, I reckon,"
said Vimes, eyeing the bottle. There was laughter from somewhere in the growing crowd.
"Why Thursday?" said the drinker. "Got me day off on Thursday."
There were a few more laughs this time. When the tension is drawing out, it doesn't take much to snap it.
"I demand you arrest me," said the drinker. "Come on, try it."
"You're not drunk enough," said Vimes. "I should go home and sleep it off if I was you."
The man's hand grasped the neck of the bottle. Here it comes, thought Vimes. By the look of him, the man had one chance in five. Fortunately, the crowd wasn't too big yet. What you didn't need at a time like this was people at the back, craning to see and asking what was going on. And the lit-up watch house was fully illuminating the lit-up man.
"Friend, if you take my advice, you'll not consider that," said Vimes.
He took another sip of his cocoa. It was only lukewarm now, but along with the cigar it meant that both his hands were occupied. That was important. He wasn't holding a weapon. No one could say afterwards that he had a weapon.
"I'm no friend to you people,"
snapped the man, and smashed the bottle on the wall by the steps. The glass tinkled to the ground. Vimes watched the man's face, watched the expression change from drink-fueled anger to agonising pain, watched the mouth open. The man swayed. Blood began to ooze from somewhere between his fingers, and a low, thin animal sound escaped from between his teeth. That was the tableau, under the light. Vimes sitting down with his hands full, the bleeding man several feet away. No fight. No one had touched anyone. He knew the way rumour worked, and he wanted this picture to fix itself in people's minds. There was even ash still on the cigar. He stayed very still for a few seconds, and then stood up, all concern.
"Come on, won't you help me, will you?" he said, tugging off his breastplate and the chainmail shirt underneath it. He grabbed his shirt sleeve and tore off a long strip.
A couple of men, jerked into action by the voice of command, steadied the man who was dripping blood. One of them reached for the hand.
"Leave it," Vimes commanded, tightening the strip of sleeve around the man's unresisting wrist. "He's got a handful of broken glass. Lay him down as gently as you can before he falls over, but don't touch nothing until I've got this tourniquet on. Sam, go into the stable and pinch Marilyn's blanket for the boy. Anyone here know Dr. Lorne? Speak up!"
Someone among the awed bystanders volunteered that they did and was sent running for him. Vimes was aware of the circle watching him. A lot of the watchmen were peering around the doorway now.
"Saw this happen once," he said aloud, and added mentally, "in 10 years' time. It was in a bar fight. Man grabbed a bottle, didn't know how to smash it. Ended up with a handful of shards, and the other guy reached down and squeezed." There was a satisfying groan from the crowd. "Anyone know who this man is?" he added. "Come on, someone must."
A voice in the crowd volunteered that the man could well be Joss Gappy, an apprentice shoemaker from New Cobblers.
"Let's hope we can save his hand, then," said Vimes. "I need a new pair of boots."
It wasn't funny at all, but it got another of those laughs, the ones people laugh out of sheer frightened nervousness. Then the crowd parted as Lorne came through.
"Ah," he said, kneeling down by Gappy, "you know, I don't know why I own a bed. Trainee bottle fighter."
"Yeah."
"Looks like you've done the right things, but I need light and a table," said Lorne. "Can your men take him into the watch house?"
Vimes had hoped it wouldn't come to that.
Oh, well, you had to make the best of it.
He pointed randomly at figures in the crowd. You and you, and you and you, and you too, lady, he said. You can help Fred and Waddy take this young man inside, OK? And you're to stop with him, and we'll leave the doors open, right? All you lot out here will know what's going on. We've got no secrets here. Everyone understand?
Yeah, but you're a copper, a voice began.
Vimes darted forward and hauled a frightened young man out of the crowd by his shirt.
Yeah, I am, he said. And see that lad over there? He's a copper too. His name's Sam Vimes. He lives in Cockbill Street with his mum. And that's Fred Colon, just got married, got a couple of rooms in Old Cobblers. And Exhibit C here is Waddy. Everyone round here knows Waddy. Billy Wiglet there, he was born in this street. Have I asked you your name?
No, the man mumbled.
That's 'cause I don't care who you are, said Vimes, letting the man go and looking round at the crowd. Listen to me, all of you. My name's John Keel. No one gets taken into this watch house without me knowing why. You're all here as witnesses. Those of you I pointed out, you come on inside to see fair play all round. Do the rest of you want to hang around to see what happens to Gappy? Fine. I'll get Snouty to bring you out some cocoa. Or you can go home. It's a cold night. You ought to be in your beds. I know I'd like to be in mine. And yes, we do know about Dolly Sisters, and we don't like it any more than you do. And we've heard about Dinwell Street, and we don't like that either. And that's all I've got to say tonight. Now, anyone who still wants to take a swing at a copper can step right up if they want to. I've got my uniform off. We'll have a go, here and now, fair and square, in front of everyone. Anyone?
Something brushed his shoulder and clattered onto the watch house steps. Then there was the sound of slipping tiles from a roof on the other side, and a man fell off the roof and into the pool of light. There were gasps from the crowd, and one or two short screams.
"Looks like you've got a volunteer,"
said someone. There was the horrible nervous sniggering again. The crowd parted to let Vimes view the sudden arrival. The man was dead. If he hadn't been when he fell off the roof, he was after he hit the ground, because no neck normally looked like that. A crossbow had fallen down with him. Vimes remembered the draft across his shoulder and went back to the watch house steps. It didn't take long to find the arrow, which had broken into several pieces.
"Anyone know this man?" he said.
The crowd, even those members of it who hadn't been able to get a good look at the fallen bowman, indicated definite ignorance. Vimes went through the man's pockets. Every single one was empty, which was all the evidence of identification he needed.
"Looks like it's going to be a long night," he said, signalling Colong to take this body inside too. "I've got to get on with my work, ladies and gentlemen. If anyone wants to stay, and frankly I'll be obliged if you do, I'll send some lads out to build a fire. Thank you for your patience."
He picked up his mail and breastplate and went back inside.
"What are they doing?" he said to Sam without turning round. "Some of them are wandering off, but most of them are standing around, Sarge," said Sam, peering around the door.
"Sarge? One of them shot at you."
"Really? Who says the man on the roof was one of them? That's an expensive bow. And he didn't have anything in his pockets. Nothing. Not so much as a used anky."
"Very odd, Sarge," said Sam loyally.
"Especially since I was expecting a piece of paper saying something like, 'I am definitely a member of the revolutionary cadre, trust me on this,'" said Vimes, looking carefully at the corpse.
"Yeah, that'd tell us he was a revolutionary all right," said Sam.
Vimes sighed and stared at the wall a moment. Then he said,
"Anyone notice anything about his bow?"
"It's the new Bolsover A7, said Fred Colon. "Not a bad bow, Sarge. Not an assassin's weapon, though."
"That's true," said Vimes,
and twisted the dead man's head so that they could see the tip of the little metal dart behind the ear.
"But this is... Fred, you know everyone. Where can I get some ginger beer at this time of night?"
"Ginger beer, Sarge?"
"Yes, Fred."
"Why do..."
Colon began.
"Don't ask, Fred. Just get half a dozen bottles, all right?"
Vimes turned to the desk on which, surrounded by a fascinated crowd, Dr. Lorne was at work on the stricken Gappy.
"How's it going?" said Vimes, pushing through.
"Slower than it'd go if people got out of the damn light,"
said Lorne, carefully moving his tweezers to a mug by Gappy's hand and dropping a bloody fragment of glass therein.
"I've seen worse on a Friday night. He'll keep the use of his fingers if that's what you want to know. He just won't be making any shoes for a while. Well done."
There was general crowd approval. Vimes looked around at the people and the coppers. There were one or two muted conversations going on. He heard phrases like "bad business" and "they say that" above the general noise. He'd played the cards well enough. Most of the lads here lived within a street or two. It was one thing to have a go at faceless bastards in uniform, but quite another to throw stones at old Fred Colon, or old Waddy, or old Billy Wiglet, who you'd known since you were 2 years old and played dead rat conkers with in the gutter. Lorne put the tweezers down and pinched the bridge of his nose.
"That's it," he said wearily. "A bit of stitching and he'll be fine." "And there's some others I need you to take a look at," said Vimes. "You know, that comes as no surprise," said the doctor. "One's got a lot of holes in his feet, one dropped through the privy roof and has got a twisted leg, and one's dead."
"I don't think I can do much about the dead one," said the doctor.
"How do you know he's dead? I realise I may regret asking that question."
"He's got a broken neck from falling off a roof, and I reckon he fell off because he got a steel crossbow bolt in his brain."
"Ah, that sounds like dead, if you want my medical opinion. Did you do it?"
"No."
"Well, you're a busy man, Sergeant. You can't be everywhere." The doctor's face cracked into a grin when he saw Vimes go red, and he walked over to the corpse.
"Yes, I'd say that life is definitely extinct," he said.
"And?"
"I want you to write that down, please, on paper, with official-sounding words like contusion and abrasions. I want you to write that down, and I want you to write down what time you found he was dead. And then, if you don't mind, two lads will take you down to look at the other two, and after you treated them, thank you, I'd like you to sign another piece of paper saying you did, and I called you in. Two copies of everything, please."
"All right. Dare I ask why?"
"I don't want anyone to say I did it."
"Why should anyone say that? You told me he fell off a roof."
"These are suspicious times, Doctor."
"Ah, here's Fred. Any luck?"
Corporal Colon was carrying a box. He put it down on the desk with a grunt.
"Old Mrs. Arbiter didn't like being knocked up in the middle of the night," he announced. "I had to give her a dollar."
Vimes didn't dare look at Lorne's face.
"Really?" he said, as innocently as possible.
"And you got the ginger beer?"
6 pence of her best stuff," said Colon. "There's 3 pence back on the bottles, by the way, and," he shuffled uneasily,
"I heard they set fire to the watch house at Dolly's sister's, Sarge. It's very bad up at Knapp Hill, too, and the Chitlin Street house got all its windows broke, and up at the Least Gate house some of the lads went out to stop kids throwing stones, and one of them drew his sword, Sarge,
and
he'll probably live, Sarge."
Dr. Lorne looked about him at the crowded office where people were still talking. Snouty was going round with a tray of cocoa. Out in the street, some of the watchmen were standing around a makeshift fire with a remnant of the crowd.
"Well, I must say I'm impressed," he said.
"Sounds like you're the only watch house not under siege tonight. I don't want to know how you did it."
"Luck played a part," said Vimes.
"And I've got 3 men who carry no personal identification whatsoever in the cells, and another anonymous would-be assassin who has been assassinated."
"Quite a problem," said Lorne.
"Now me, I just have to deal with simple mysteries like what the rash means."
"I intend to solve mine quite quickly," said Vimes.
The assassin moved quietly from roof to roof until he was well away from the excitement around the watch house. His movements could be called cat-like, except that he did not stop to spray urine up against things. Eventually, he reached one of the upper world's many hidden places where several thickets of chimneys made a little sheltered space, invisible from the ground and from most of the surrounding roofscape. He didn't enter it immediately, but circled it for a while, moving with absolute silence from one vantage point to another. What would have intrigued a watcher who knew the ways of Ankh-Morpork's Guild of Assassins was how invisible this one was. When he moved, you saw movement. When he stopped, he wasn't there. Magic would have been suspected, and, in an oblique way, the watcher would have been right. 90% of most magic merely consists of knowing one extra fact. At last, the figure appeared satisfied and dropped into the space. He picked up a bag from its nesting place between the smoking pots, and there was some faint swishing and heavier breathing that suggested clothes were being changed. After a minute or so, he emerged from the hidden niche, and now, somehow, he was visible. Hard to see, yes, one shadow among others, but nevertheless, there in a way that he had not been before when he'd been as visible as the breeze. He dropped lightly onto a lean-to roof, and thence to the ground, where he stepped into a handy shadow. Then there was a further transformation. It was done quite easily. The evil little crossbow was disassembled and slipped into the pockets of a clink-free velvet bag. The soft leather slippers were exchanged for a pair of heavier boots that had been stashed in the shadow, and a black hood was pushed back. He walked lightly round the corner and waited a few minutes. A coach came along, its torches trailing flame. It slowed briefly, and its door opened and shut. The assassin settled back in his seat as the coach picked up speed again. There was a very faint lamp in the carriage. Its glow revealed a female figure relaxing in the shadows opposite. As the coach passed a torch, there was a suggestion of lilac silk.
"You've missed a bit," said the figure. It produced a lilac-coloured handkerchief and held it in front of the young man's face. "Spit!" came the command. Reluctantly, he did so. A hand wiped his cheek and then held the cloth up to light.
"Dark green," said the woman. "How strange! I understand, Havelock, that you scored zero in your examination for stealthy movement."
"May I ask how you found that out, madam?"
"Oh, one hears things," madam said lightly. "One just has to hold money up to one's ear."
"Well, it was true," said the assassin.
"And why was this?"
"The examiner thought I'd used trickery, madam."
"And did you?"
"Of course. I thought that was the idea."
"And you never attended his lessons," he said.
"Oh, I did. Religiously."
"He says he never saw you at any of them."
Havelock smiled.
"And your point, madam, is?"
Madam laughed.
"Will you take some champagne?"
There was the sound of a bottle moving in an ice bucket.
"Thank you, madam, but no." "As you wish. I shall. And now, a report, please."
"I can't believe what I saw. I thought he was a thug, and he is a thug. You can see his muscles thinking for him. But he overrules them moment by moment. I think I saw a genius at work, but..."
"What?"
"He's just a sergeant, madam."
"Don't underestimate him on that account. It is a very useful rank for the right man. The optimum balance of power and responsibility. Incidentally, they say he can read the street through the soles of his boots and keeps them very thin for that purpose."
"Hmm. There are plenty of different surfaces, that's true, but..."
"You're always so solemn about these things, Havelock. Not at all like your late father. Think... mythologically. He can read the street. He can hear its voice, take its temperature, read its mind. It talks to him through his boots. Policemen are just as superstitious as other people. Every other watch house was attacked tonight. Oh, Swing's people egged it on, but it was malice and stupidity that did most damage."
"But not in Treacle Mine Road?"
"No. Keel opened the doors and let the street inside. I wish I knew more about him. I'm told that in Pseudopolis he was considered to be slow, thoughtful, sensible. He certainly seems to have bloomed here."
"I inhumed a man who attempted to nip him in the bud."
"Really? That doesn't sound like Swing. How much do I owe you?"
The young man called Havelock gave a shrug. "Call it a dollar," he said.
"That's very cheap."
"He wasn't worth more. I should warn you, though. Soon you may want me to deal with Keel."
"Surely someone like him wouldn't side with people like Winder and Swing?"
"He's a side all by himself. He is a complication. You may think it best if he ceased to complicate."
The rattling of the coach underlined the silence this remark caused. It was moving through a richer part of the city now, where there was more light, and the curfew, being for poorer people, was less rigorously observed. The figure opposite the assassin stroked the cat on her lap.
"No. He'll serve some purpose," said Madame. "Everyone is telling me about Keel. In a world where we all move in curves, he proceeds in a straight line. And going straight in a world of curves makes things happen."
She stroked the cat. It yowled softly. It was Ginger and had an expression of astonishing smugness, although periodically it scratched at its collar.
"On a different subject," she said. "What was that business with the book? I did not like to take too much notice."
"Oh, it was an extremely rare volume I was able to track down on the nature of concealment."
"That stupid hulk of a boy burned it."
"Yes, that was a piece of luck. I was afraid he might try to read it, although," Havelock smiled wanly, "someone would have had to help him with the longer words."
"Was it valuable?"
"Priceless, especially now it has been destroyed."
"Ah, it contained information of value, possibly involving the colour dark green. Will you tell me?"
"I could tell you," Havelock smiled again, "but then I would have to find someone to pay me to kill you."
"Then don't tell me. But I do think Dog Botherer is an unpleasant nickname."
"When your name is Vetinari, madam,
"'You're happy enough if it's merely dog-botherer. "'Can you drop me off a little way from the guild, please? "'I'll go in via the roof. "'I have a tiger to attend to before I go up to, you know.' "'A tiger! How exciting!' "'She stroked the cat again. "'You've found your way in yet?'
"'Veterinari shrugged. "'I've known my way for years, madam, "'but now he has half a regiment around the palace.' 4 or 5 guards on each door with irregular patrols and spot checks. I can't get through them.
Only let me get inside, please, and the men inside are no problem.
The cat pawed at its collar.
Is it possible that he is allergic to diamonds? Said Madam. She held up the cat. Is he allergic to diamonds, then?
Havelock sighed, but inwardly, because he respected his aunt. He just wished she was a bit more sensible about cats. He felt instinctively that if you were going to fondle a cat while discussing matters of intrigue, then it should be a long-haired white one. It shouldn't be an elderly street tom with regular bouts of flatulence.
"'What about the sergeant?' he said, shifting along the seat as politely as possible.
The lady, all in lilac, lowered the cat gently onto the seat. There was a distressing smell.
"'I think I should meet Mr. Keel as soon as possible.' she said. Perhaps he can be harnessed. The party is tomorrow night. Do you mind opening the window?
A little later that night, Downey was walking unsteadily back to his study after a convivial time in the prefect's common room, when he noticed that a torch had gone out. With a swiftness that might have surprised someone who saw no further than his flushed face and unsteady walk, he pulled out a dagger and scanned the corridor. He glanced up at the ceiling, too. There were grey shadows everywhere, but nothing more than that. Sometimes torches did go out all by themselves. He stepped forward. When he woke up in his bed next morning, he put the headache down to some bad brandy. And some skag had painted orange and black stripes on his face. It started to rain again. Vimes liked the rain. Street crime went down when it rained. People stayed indoors. Some of the best nights of his career had been rainy, when he'd stood in the shadows in the lee of some building, head tucked in so that there was barely anything showing between his helmet and his collar, and listened to the silvery rustle of the rain. Once he'd been standing so quietly, so withdrawn, so not there, that a fleeing robber who'd evaded his pursuers had leaned against him to catch his breath. And when Vimes put his arms around him and whispered, "Gotcha!" into his ear, the man had apparently done in his trousers what his dear mother, some 40 years before, had very patiently taught him not to do. The people had gone home. The sewn-up gappy had been escorted to Old Cobbler's, where Fred Colon had patiently explained events to the man's parents, with his round red face radiating honesty. Lorne was possibly getting some use out of his bed. And the rain gurgled in the downpipes and gushed from the gargoyles and swirled in the gutters and deadened all sound. Useful stuff, rain. Vimes picked up the bottle of Mrs. Arbiter's best ginger beer. He remembered it. It was as gassy as hell and therefore hugely popular. A young boy could, with encouragement and training, eventually manage to belch the whole first verse of the national anthem after just one swig. This is an important social attribute when you're 8 years old. He'd chosen Colon and Waddy for this task. He wasn't going to involve young Sam. It wasn't that what he was planning was illegal as such. It was just that it had the same colour and smell as something illegal, and Vimes didn't want to have to explain. The cells were old, much older than the building above them. The iron cages were fairly new and didn't take up all the space. There were other cellars beyond an arch containing nothing more than rats and rubbish, but importantly, they couldn't be seen from the cages. Vimes got the men to carry the dead bowman through. Nothing wrong with that. It was the middle of the night. Filthy weather, no sense in waking up the people at the mortuary when there was a nice cold cellar. He watched through the spy hole in the door as the body was taken past the cells. It caused a certain stir, especially in the first man he'd brought in. The other two had the look of men who'd seen a lot of bad stuff in the name of making money. If they were hired to steal or murder or be a copper, it was all the same to them, and they'd learned not to react too readily to deaths that were not their own. The first man, though, was getting nervous. Vimes had nicknamed him Ferret. He was the best dressed of the three, all in black. The dagger had been expensive, and Vimes noticed he had a silver death's head ring on one finger. The other two had dressed nondescript, and their weapons had been workmanlike, nothing much to look at but well used. No real assassin would wear jewellery at work. It was dangerous, and it shone. But Ferret wanted to be a big man. He probably checked himself in the mirror before he went out to make sure he looked cool. He was the sort of little twerp that got a kick out of showing his dagger to women in bars. Ferret, in short, had big dreams. Ferret had an imagination. Well, that was fine. The watchman returned and picked up the packages Vimes had prepared. "Remember, we do it fast," he said. "They're worried, they're tired, no one's come for them, and they've just seen a very dead colleague. We don't want to give the first two time to think, understand?" They nodded. "And we'll leave the little one until last. I want him to have lots of time." Ferret was considering his prospects. Regrettably, this didn't take long. He'd already had a row with the other two, some rescue team they'd been. They weren't even dressed right, but the brown jobs hadn't done thing as per spec. Everyone knew they backed away. They weren't supposed to fight back or show any kind of intelligence. The main cell door was flung back. "It's ginger beer time," roared someone. And a watchman ran through with a box of bottles, disappeared into the rooms beyond. There wasn't much light in here. Ferret cowered against the wall and saw two watchmen unlock the cell next door, drag the shackled occupants upright and out into the corridor, and then hustle him round the corner. The voices had a slight echo. "Hold him down, mind his legs." "Right, let's have the bottle. Give it a proper shake, otherwise it won't work." "Okay, friend, anything you want to tell us? Your name?" "No. Well, it's like this. Right now, we don't care a whole lot if you talk or not." There was a loud pop, a hiss, and then a scream, an explosion of agony. After it had died away, the trembling Ferret heard someone say, "Quick, get the next one before the captain catches us." He cringed back as two watchmen rushed into the next cell, dragged out the struggling prisoner and hustled him into the darkness. "All right, one chance. Are you going to talk? Yes? No? Too late." Once again the pop, once again the hiss, once again the scream. It was louder and longer this time, and ended in a kind of bubbling sound. Ferret crouched against the wall, fingers in his mouth. Around the corner, sitting in the light of one lantern, Colon nudged Vimes, wrinkled his nose and pointed down. There was a gully that ran between all the cells as a primitive sop to hygiene. Now, a thin trickle was inching its way along it. Ferret was nervous. "Gotcha," thought Vimes. But a good imagination needs a little more time. He leaned forward, and the other two moved closer expectantly. "So," he said in a low whisper, "have you boys had your holidays yet?" After a few minutes of very small talk, he stood up, strode round to the last occupied cell, unlocked the door and grabbed Ferret, who was trying to squeeze into a corner. "No, please, I'll tell you whatever you want to know," the man yelled. "Really?" said Vimes. "What's the orbital velocity of the moon?" "What?" "Oh, you'd like something simpler," said Vimes, dragging the man out of the cell. "Fred, Waddy, he wants to talk, bring a notebook." It took half an hour. Fred Colon wasn't a fast writer, and when the painful sound of his efforts concluded with the stab of his last full stop, Vimes said, "Okay, sir. And now you write down at the end, 'I, Gerald Leastways, currently staying at the Young Men's Pagan Association, am making this statement of my own free will and not under duress,' and then you sign it or else. Got it?" "Yes, sir." The initials GL had been inscribed on the dagger. Vimes believed them. He'd met plenty of leastwayses in his career, and they tended to spill their guts at the mere thought of spilling their guts. And when they did, you got everything. Anyone who'd seen the ginger beer trick used on someone else would confess to anything. "Well, now," he said cheerfully, standing up, "thank you for your cooperation. Want to lift to Cable Street?" Ferret's expression, if not his mouth, said, "Huh?" "We've got to drop off your friends," Vimes went on, raising his voice slightly. "Todsey and Muffer. We'll drop the dead one off at the mortuary. Just a bit of paperwork for you." He nodded at Colon. "One copy of your helpful statement, one certificate of death from the pox doctor for the late mystery man, and rest assured we'll try to track down his murderer. A chitty from Mossy about the ointment he put on Muffer's feet. Oh, and a receipt for 6 bottles of ginger beer." He put a hand on Ferret's shoulder and gently walked him round into the next cellar, where Todsey and Muffer were sitting gagged, bound and livid with rage. On a table nearby was a box containing 6 flagons of ginger beer. The corks were heavily wired down. Ferret stared at Vimes, who inserted a finger in his mouth, blew up his cheeks and flicked out the finger with a loud pop. Waddy hissed between his teeth. Fred Colon opened his mouth, but Vimes clamped his hand over it. "No, don't,"
he said. "Funny thing, Gerald, but Fred here just screams out loud at times for no reason at all."
"You tricked me!"
Ferrick wailed. Vimes patted him on the shoulder.
"Tricked?" he growled.
"How so, Gerald?"
"You made me think you were doing a ginger beer trick."
"Ginger beer trick?" said Vimes, his brow wrinkling.
"What's that?"
"You know. You brought the stuff down here."
"We don't drink alcohol on duty, Gerald," said Vimes severely. "What's wrong with a little ginger beer?"
"We don't know any tricks with the stuff, Gerald. What tricks do you know? Seen any good tricks lately, Gerald? Do tell."
At last it dawned on Ferret that he should stop talking. It was about half an hour too late. The expressions on what could be seen of the faces of Todsey and Muffer suggested that they wanted a very personal word with him.
"I demand protective custody," he managed.
"Just when I'm letting you go, Gerald," said Vimes.
"As you said in your statement, what was it, Fred? Something about just obeying orders? All that stuff about mixing with the mobs and throwing things at coppers and soldiers? You didn't want to do that, I know. You didn't like being round in Cable Street watching people being beaten up and being told what to confess to, because it's plain to me that you're not that sort. You're small fry. I understand that. I say we'll call it quits. How about you?"
"Please, I'll tell you all I know," Ferret squeaked.
"You mean you haven't?" Vimes roared. He spun around and grabbed a bottle.
"Yes! No! I mean, if I sit quiet, I'm sure I'll remember some more."
Vimes held his gaze for a moment and then dropped the bottle back in the crate.
"All right," he said.
"It'll be $1 a day, meals extra."
"Right you are, sir."
Vimes watched Ferret scuttle back into his cell and shut the door behind him. Then he turned to Fred and Waddy.
"Go and wake up Marilyn," he said. "Let's deliver the other three."